The next case set for argument is in the matter of the estate of Jerry Simon. Elliot Bloom appears on behalf of the appellant, Linda Simon. Michael Strain is appearing on behalf of Appley Estate. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. Bloom, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. You may proceed, Mr. Bloom, with your argument.
Mr. Chief Justice, my colleague, and may it please the court. My name is Elliot Bloom, and I represent the petitioner in this matter, Linda Simon. Linda and the decedent, Jerry Simon, were together 14 years and married for seven. Linda and Jerry worked side by side together during this time on a ranch, primarily raising horses. Prior to them meeting and after the divorce of Jerry's second wife, the decedent created a will in 2003. Where he devised everything to his daughter. He never changed or amended his will after marrying Linda, and the decedent passed away effectively disinheriting his spouse. The only issue before this court today is whether the circuit court erred in denying Linda Simon's petition for an intestate share under SDCL 29A-2-301. Today we ask this court to reverse the lower court's ruling for three primary reasons. Number one, the lower court incorrectly compared the value of the horses Linda received to the total value of the asset that it emanated from, and also the elective share that Linda could receive, which is not contemplated by the statute or case law. Number two, the lower court's characterization of Casey Humble's testimony is not a statement that falls within the statute, as a statement made by the decedent because it was made prior to Linda and the decedent marrying, was in the context of divorce and before the transfers were even made.
Well, but isn't that really a question of fact for the fact finder as to what the context was and what, I mean, when you get into the notion of intent, you're kind of categorizing these things, but isn't that really for the fact finder rather than for us to decide this is what the context was?
Yes and no, Chief Justice. In terms of this statute, the court can only analyze in determining this statute specific types of evidence. And one of those pieces of evidence is statements from the decedent that indicate that the transfers were in lieu of a testamentary provision. So that testimony from Casey Humble has to go and relate back to those transfers and it being in lieu of a testamentary provision. Not challenging whether or not the statement was made or possibly even what he said, but the analyzation of Casey Humble's testimony to this statute in determining was this decedent's statement in relating to the transfers being in lieu of a testamentary provision, Casey Humble even admitted that he never, the decedent and him never talked to or was talked to about regarding the transfers.
So that conversation though, I mean, it was a conversation when he's talking about marrying her. So the significance of it being before the marriage seems, it seems not that significant to me given the context of what they were talking about there. And in that context of do you really want to marry her, then he brings up, explains that he's got a will that takes care of what he wants to happen to the ranch. How is that not relevant to what his intent ultimately was with respect to her?
And I think there's a difference between testamentary intent, what the decedent wanted, versus what the statute indicates that the lower court has to consider. And that means what the transfers meant. What did the decedent mean from these transfers and whether it was lieu in the testamentary provision? It can be both in terms of testamentary intent being the broader category and the intent that these transfers be in lieu of a testamentary provision fitting within that. But we still have to have testimony indicating whether these transfers were in lieu of a testamentary provision. A lot of the case law, even though it's very slim, don't have those statements because people usually don't talk like that. We don't have a statement indicating whether Casey Humble or the decedent told Casey Humble, hey, I transferred horses to Linda and this was in lieu of her inheritance or this was her inheritance. We don't have that here.
Is it a question of fact that we review for clear error when the court determined that these were made with the intent?
No, Your Honor, I believe this is a mixed question of law and fact, where we're applying the facts to a question of law. The estate of Cole, or estate of King, sorry, out of the Colorado Court of Appeals as recently as 2019 indicated that these questions of whether this evidence fits within the statute is a mixed question of law and fact that this court can review de novo. And in the alternative, even if we look at these factual questions and this court was to analyze it under a clearly erroneous standard, we still believe that clear error was made in regards to the testimony and the statements.
Clear error is essentially the focus upon the intent more so than the transfers. The intent that the ranch stay in the family as a more predominant inquiry or area of inquiry rather than transfers or what was intended by transfers and whether the transfers had even occurred at the time of the statements we were just visiting about.
Justice Salter, I, in terms of testamentary intent on the clear error part, the court can find that it was the decedent's intent that the ranch stay in the family. That's one question that we're not really even challenging. It's the application of that testamentary intent to the statute before it.
And that would be a clear error. That would be part of the mistake that you would suggest is revealed through an examination of the records of whole.
Yes, Justice. Yes. So indicating on the circuit courts, going back to my first point, and before I get there, I want to discuss a little bit about the history of this statute. Now this statute was not present at common law. At common law, a man's or a woman's will was automatically revoked following his marriage or the birth of issue unless provisions were made in the will in contemplation of such events. This common law was eventually codified in South Dakota, and as early as In re Larson's estate in 1904, this court mentions that fact. The codification of the common law has since been repealed in South Dakota and replaced with the omitted spouse statute before this court in SDCL 29A-2-301. This statute indicates that if a decedent made a will prior to marrying his spouse and doesn't change it, that the spouse is entitled to an intestate share. Unless the estate or the proponent of the will can satisfy one of three exceptions. The first exception being, was the will made in contemplation of the marriage? Number two, whether the will indicated it's effective regardless any subsequent marriage. And number three, and the exception that we're here today, is that the testator provided for the spouse by transfer outside the will, and the intent that the transfer be in lieu of a testamentary provision is shown by one of three pieces of evidence. The testator's statements is reasonably inferred from the amount of the transfer or other evidence. And unless these exceptions can be proven, the spouse is entitled to an intestate share because the statute's designed to avoid the unintentional disinheritance of a spouse of a decedent who executed a will prior to the marriage. And so in the courts.
So I want to ask you about that first clause of subsection 3. Testator provided for the spouse by transfer of outside the will. So my understanding is after death, the estate paid off the mortgage that Ms. Simon had taken out. She received maybe $100,000 and I think maybe another $100,000 of personal property that, and so I guess I'm asking, what does that mean provided for? Does that mean you have to set the spouse up for the rest of their life? What does that language mean in terms of interpreting that?
That's a good question, Justice. Provided for, if we go back to the estate of Groper v. Groper out of Missouri Court of Appeals, they looked at this, that the decedent has to provide for the spouse outside of the will. And I think that comes back to, what did she receive? Is it a de minimis value in terms of what the decedent wanted, or is it a big value in terms of she could, this is what the decedent wanted, and that transfer was intent of a testamentary provision? When we look at some of these cases, like in State versus Christensen v. Christensen out of Utah, the spouse received 4% of a $10 million estate.
If this was a transfer that was made by the estate after the testator died, does it even fall within 301? Because these are transfers by the testator that are intended, and we're defining intent, the courts are, to determine this. It's possible, and I don't know if that's this case, but it's possible that an estate, for one reason or another, gratuitously, to try to settle, any number of reasons, could make a transfer after the testator's death. That doesn't seem to be the same sort of transfer that they're talking about in the statute.
You're correct, Justice. That wouldn't be a statute or a transfer that's contemplated by the statute, because there's no intent there. The testator didn't make that transfer. Just going back to Casey Humble's testimony and why we don't believe it's relevant to the statute, and it was improperly considered, is because it was a conversation and testimony before the transfers were made. The question becomes, how can the decedent have an intent of that transfer before even transferring it?
And how broadly do we define transfer? Is the joint ownership in the American Quarter Horse Association even a transfer? What does the law prescribe regarding the definition of transfer?
Thank you, Justice Curran. It would be considered a transfer from all what the cases indicate. Having a non-test or a non-probate transfer in putting a spouse on a joint account or on the AQHA membership here would be considered a transfer. However, like the court in Ivy v. Estate v. Ivy out of Alabama in 2017, the fact of the transfer itself is just the first part of the inquiry. We still have to look at whether that transfer was intended to provide for the spouse and be in lieu of a testamentary provision.
So,
go ahead.
Well, I was just gonna, you were with regard to the statements and the part of that stat, that provision that refers, that they relate to the transfer in lieu of the testamentary provision as shown by the testator statements, and I get your argument on that, but there's also this last part of that, or other evidence. And to me, that opens the door to anything that might be relevant to try to glean the overall intent. So even if they can't be considered for that purpose, wouldn't they still be relevant overall to determine intent?
Respectfully, Justice Devaney, I disagree, because those provisions, these specific evidence, we have two specific categories, which this court has indicated when we have more specific categories under the general that maybe they carry more weight. We're not here, and we wouldn't be arguing that we look at the weight. But we have this other evidence category that's in the conjunctive of the other two, or is in between each one of those types of evidence. Meaning it needed to relate back to is what other evidence is available to indicate the intent of the transfer being in lieu of a testamentary provision. So what is that evidence? And some courts have listed factors, Alabama being one of them, and I think the estate cited it in its brief, these eight factors that, well, what is other evidence? Well, Alabama's statute's a little different than ours in that it has a very broad omitted spouse statute, indicating that these transfers can be reasonably proven. So factors in that scenario may be warranted. Here, I don't believe factors are warranted. And even if they are, what is that other type of evidence?
But it's ultimately really, as you say, it seems like it's really dependent upon the facts. It's fact-bound, as we sometimes say. So, for instance, the fact that Linda's own real estate remained in her name is neither, tell me if you're right or you agree or not, but it's neither categorically
relevant or not relevant, it depends upon whether it bears upon intent. The mere fact, objectively viewed, is, doesn't, it, unless it relates to intent, it wouldn't be other evidence under R301(3) statute.
That's correct, Justice Alter. And the evidence the court needs to consider under this statute and the estate needs to prove in these, this exception is what was the intent behind the transfers. Now, going back to Justice Devaney's question, and well, what does this other evidence mean then? And thought about this in terms of actions. We have statements, we have the value that she received and what we should compare that with, and our argument would be that would be the probate estate. But then we have this other evidence category, and we would propose that it be actions. If the testator had a state of just coins, gold coins, the action of giving half those gold coins to the spouse and half of these gold coins to other beneficiaries, the action alone of splitting that estate could go to the intent that the transfer to the spouse was in lieu of a testamentary provision. Now, the estate of Cole out of Colorado, or actually Michigan Court of Appeals, tried to go into what this other evidence was. And they indicated that the decedent made codicils that were executed, or the decedent met with attorneys and decided not to change it after discussing the spouse with the attorneys.
Mr. Bloom, I'm going to interrupt you. Your time's up, but you can finish those arguments and rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Chief Justice.
Strain, you may proceed.
Chief Justice, may it please the court.
Counsel.
Good to see you all again. To clear up something out of the front here, I think we've touched on it now. There are some representations made that is this a de novo review or is this a clearly erroneous review? It's clearly erroneous. There's no questions of law here. The law is in the code.
He's challenged the conclusions of law. Does that change your view?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because the court properly applied the law from that standpoint as to it relates to the facts that were presented to it. So it's not a mixed question of law and fact. The question is, was there sufficient evidence put forward to establish the intent of the testator?
I see that argument. What about the thought, though, that the court misapplied the 301 statute, expanded the universe of information, and made an error in applying the standard of the law by considering things that, in Mr. Bloom's view, in any event, didn't bear upon intent? It seems like before we get to the quantum of the evidence, the sufficiency of the evidence, we might have to resolve something there, but I don't know what your thoughts are.
As I see it, from my perspective here, the statute is very clear. Is the when the purpose of the statute, as all the cases talk about, is the unintentional omission of a spouse from a will. This was intentional. He had a will. Before he got married, he talked about with McCasey, third marriage, coming up here. I've got a will, and Denise and my daughter, DeLynn, gets the ranch and goes to my grandkids, fifth generation ranch. Now, why was that important? So we're clear, Simons Inc. owns the ranch. Jerry Simons was 100% owner of all the shares of the ranch. The only way that she would, the only way that DeLynn gets the ranch is by acquiring the shares of the company. And how do we know that? The evidence clearly shows that, lays that out. And there's an old saying here concerning, and it goes to the intent issue and the application of the mixed law and fact. The law is clear. The court is to consider the other evidence, and Justice, you hit on that a little bit. We talk about under 29A, 2301 sub 2 is reasonably inferred from the amount of the transfer or other evidence. Now, I wasn't the English major in college. I probably should have been. So political science doesn't teach us English that well. But phrased another way, it says reasonably inferred from the amount of the transfer or reasonably inferred from other evidence. Use or in that context, what's the other evidence reasonably infer? to determine what the intent of the testator was and in also taking care of the spouse outside of the will.
So we're talking about $106,000 approximately, I'm ballparking, for her total asset compilation between the horses and some trailers and some vehicles, et cetera, as compared to a $1.3 million estate. Mm-hmm. In, you know, and this is our first opportunity to interpret this, the, this exception. In the research that you've done, can you point the court to other cases that have a percentage similar to this, and I'm trying to discern whether or not this is a de minimis transfer.
Yeah.
The cases I've looked at have not been in an 8% share of a total estate as far as a transfer in lieu of testamentary intent. Can you point the court to any case that would affirm a transfer in lieu of testamentary intent in this range?
Yes, Your Honor. There's a case out of South Carolina. It's called the Timmerman case, T-I-M-M-E-R-E-N case, and it references two other cases where, in that case, the amount of the value of return was less than 20%, and they consider that to be enough. The issue isn't the math, but the bottom line, they said, even if that size of transfer there, it was the intent of the testator, and that was his intent to take care of the spouse outside of the will.
Certainly a factor.
Yeah, exactly correct. Thank you. And so, and that's the piece here, Toby. We analyze the case. We get back to numbers. Is there a magical formula out here we have to use? Is that if she doesn't get 46%, then obviously she wasn't taking care of the estate? No. Two pieces here. We have two assets. We have a ranch, and we got horses. Now, a bigger question for me is always, and we have to look at it, really, how did Jerry value the ranch? Is it numbers, money? If you do that approach, I'm from West River, you all know that. Ranchers don't think their ranches are worth very much because if the Meade County tax assessor finds out what it, you know, it is, you don't want to pay more taxes, so it's not worth that much. Trying to crawl in his head. He also had the other thing that they had, which is called horses. And you know me and horses. You know, he had 140 plus horses. What's more important, the land or the horses? In his mind, they could have been of equal value. The old saying, good judgment comes from experience.
So wouldn't that, getting in his mind, wouldn't that come from some statements that he made to someone about how he viewed those particular things, that he viewed the horses to be equal with the land, to continue with your argument?
The statement, that's the piece that's there. It's a matter of the judge heard the testimony of the daughter and of Casey concerning how does people think out there and how they operate. And that's a matter of judging a witness, too, which is, again, goes back to it's clearly erroneous standard. The judge had the opportunity to review the witnesses. With that piece in play, that's all we do know for sure, to answer that question, he had really two assets, horses and the ranch. That old saying, good judgment comes from experience. Experience comes from bad judgment. What experience did Jerry have concerning the ranch and wives? First wife, he had a first divorce, he had to buy her back out, buy her half back out. Second divorce, she got a share, she got it, he got that back in the divorce. Third time around, he's going to get exercise some good judgment here about how to keep it in the family for five generations. But he's got to take care of his new wife. He has two assets. Horses and ranch. And he clearly said, ranch goes to my daughter. So how does he take care of his wife with the remaining assets that he has?
So he modified his will after the second divorce, is that correct?
Correct.
But he did not do so after his third marriage.
Correct. No modifications were made after the third marriage. In fact, the discussions were had before with Casey that before he was going to get married, I'm going to marry her. Well, if you read the record, it probably ain't the smartest thing to do, but if something happened, what's going to happen to the ranch? I got a will, and she's going to get it, and my kids are going to get it. That shows intent of what he wants to do. However, he's not an inconsiderate cowboy out there. He knows he has to take care of his wife. So what can he take care of with? The horses. And that's the thing about the facts being spun here. It seems like nowadays things get spun. Let's test the facts. She wasn't on any bank account, according to their statement of facts. She's on the Great Western account, joint account. She wasn't on an insurance policy. You're right. You know why? No insurance. She wasn't part of any 401k. You know what? You're right. You know why? No 401k. He had horses, period.
And she didn't have any horses when they got married. She brought three to the ranch to start with. Prior to, they were all dead when they got married. She had nothing in the horse business. After he got married, the first horse he got was called Moreau Flamabars, or Frenchman's Guide. Well, this is a big stud, and he's got 147 horses. You know what that stud does. Mares and horses do something. They make more colts. And every colt after that got put in that new account they created, transferred the AQHA account to joint tenancy. That's a transfer, inter vitis transfer. He fed the horses, took care of the horses on the ranch, on his place. Those are transfers to be considered also in determining whether or not he's taking care of her outside the will. And that happened. All these horses acquired. The numbers were set out there, like 100, ran those numbers this morning. Oh, I'm out of time.
That's good. You're good. That light's not working. Go ahead.
Dang, I wanted to be out of time.
You can stop anytime you want.
You can't stop.
Okay. The amount of money put in by Jerry Simons for these horses during the lifetime she got the benefit of is lifetime transfer. I'm sorry, I can't talk well anymore. But it occurred, and you need to consider that also, and the court did in the process, determining that very clear. He took care of her outside the will. This is how it happened. So clearly erroneous, reasonable minds. Jerry knew what he was doing, taking care of both parties.
You're encouraging the court to adopt the Ferguson factors. Are they needed in light of the provisions of the exceptions set out in the statute, what we have in subparagraph 3?
I think you need to look. I think the Ferguson factors set forth the considerations to make, and every one of those applies in this case. If there's nothing, I got a green light now. Do I got to go 15 more minutes? Or? It's been a privilege again, you folks. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Strain. Mr. Bloom, you may proceed with a 5-minute rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. And I'd like to talk a little bit about Justice Kern's questions. And one of the first questions she asked is, were there cases that are analogous to the situation we have? And one of the main cases is the estate of Ferguson out of the Missouri Court of Appeals out of 2004. In that case, the testator transferred between $144,000 and $148,000 outside the will in a state that was worth about $1.4 million. And in that case, the court indicated that there wasn't evidence in regards to whether the intent of those transfers were in lieu of a testamentary provision. Mr. Strain indicated that it's more akin to Timmerman, which is a South Carolina Court of Appeals. In that case, the spouse received $1.1 million out of the non-probate transfers. And I may be wrong, but I don't ever see what the percentage was of that amount that she received from the estate. Now, in the matter of Taggart's estate, which is New Mexico, there the spouse did receive 20% of the testator's estate. And the court found that there was no omitted spouse statute didn't apply.
Mr. Bloom, can I have just a moment? I know I don't want to take too much of your time, and I really don't want to spring this new thing on you, but can I just put something out there? We're talking about standards of review and legal questions and clearly erroneous questions for factual determinations, but I was thinking, as Mr. Strain was talking, and as Justice Kern and this discussion follows about these percentages, it almost seems like at the end of the day, presuming that you have an application that's correct under the 301 statute, the facts themselves, to the extent they're disputed, are resolved and reviewed for clear error. It almost seems like where you end up seems like a discretionary call. And the question then becomes, hey, is this percentage within the range of permissible choices? There's no right or wrong answer, perhaps. Is it within this discretionary range? And I realize I'm catching you very, very cold in that regard. So if you want to just say, it's too late. That's fine. But I'm just curious about your thoughts.
Yeah, and Justice Alito, that's a great point. And it is discretionary in one category of evidence that the court can consider. And that's, what is the reasonable inference from the amount of the transfers? Does this court take a hardline view of, hey, it needs to get close or reasonably close to the intestate share that the spouse would receive? Or is it a discretionary question, making it more broad, and is she provided for? Now, some cases say getting $4 million out of a $5 million life insurance policy would be provided for. Or is $100,000 out of a $100,000 transfer out of a $1.3 million estate not being provided for when it only accounts to about 7.99% of the total value? We don't even get close to the elective share percentage in terms of that percentage. So it is discretionary in that aspect, Justice Salter. And I'd like to also point out real quickly, the Ferguson factors, when we look at those Ferguson factors, most of those factors are already the types of evidence that the court can consider. One of those factors, number three, a valid prenuptial agreement, courts have considered that being a transfer, that the spouse waived her rights to this omitted spouse share in completing the prenuptial agreement. The other factors go into the length of the marriage. And the length of the marriage, the statements that the testator had concerning the transfers, the statements made from the testator concerning the old will in relation to the new will. The biggest point in regards to Alabama, I do want to point out that their statute is different than ours, in that they do broadly characterize what the transfers mean. And going back to those factors, most of those factors do encompass what the court could consider here. We would ask from this court, in reviewing the evidence, that this wasn't a short marriage. This was an 7-year marriage, and they were together for 14 years. This is not a case where the testator and the decedent get married, and a few months later, the decedent passes away without changing his will. We do have time. This couple worked together on this ranch. So in viewing the statute, in regards to the court's conclusions of law that it made, and looking at the evidence that it applied to that statute, we believe clear de novo error was made, and we ask that this court reverse the lower court's holding in determining that Linda is not entitled to intestate share.
Thank you, Mr. Bloom.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted. We'll be in recess for 5 minutes.